From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's a part of KCRW's independent producer project. And on this episode, another program created for Unfictional by legendary radio storyteller Joe Frank. Lately, he's been producing brand new work after over 30 years of blowing minds and influencing a couple of generations of radio producers. Like Nick Vanderkolk, who has experience pushing radio boundaries of his own with the podcast Love and Radio and his work on the NPR story show Snap Judgment.
I feel a little ridiculous because I'm speaking to you from my bathtub in Berkeley, California.
Like a lot of us, Nick remembers the first time he heard a Joe Frank program.
It was a story about a man who works at a circus and falls in love with a lion tamer. And it turns out that she's cheating on him with one of the lions. I think what was shocking to me was later finding out that Joe Frank used to be host for Weekend Edition. The idea that someone who was as imaginative and weird and wonderful as Joe Frank was the host of a major NPR show. I mean, it really hit home for me how different NPR was. They were willing to take a lot more risks and experiment with stuff. Let's get some more of that, you know what I mean? Let's get back to that sense of risk-taking.
On this episode, an examination of the nature of reality itself. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional with Reality Check by Joe Frank.
I've been driving cross-country. I'm in a motel. It's late afternoon. I'm so tired that I decide to go to bed and get back on the road early the next morning. I go to sleep and wake up refreshed. Dawn is breaking. I pack my things and get in my car. As I drive, the sky grows darker. I seem to be heading into a vast, pitch-black storm sweeping over the plains. I turn on my headlights. It's mystifying because there's no rain or thunder or wind and no cars on the road. I begin to feel a mounting sense of dread. Something unnatural is happening. I've never seen anything like it. An immense darkness seems to be spreading over the world. Alarmed, I turn on the radio, moving the dial from station to station. I hear talk, music, commercials. Everything seems to be normal. Are these people unaware of what's approaching? Finally, I see a gas station with its lights on, up ahead. I pull up next to the office, jump out of my car, and run in. The man behind the counter is watching a ball game on TV. The clock above him shows 10:20. Suddenly, I realize I slept for about 3 hours, and it's later the same night. As I walk out of the office, I see my parents standing by a gas pump. My father is barefoot, his hair matted, wearing filthy gray sweatpants with a tattoo of a pair of cross tennis rackets on his arm. My mother, standing beside him, is in a torn prom dress, wobbly high-heeled pumps, grasping a shopping cart piled high with junk. They ask me for money because they say they've lost their bus tickets to Atlanta, where my father has an appointment for a job interview, and my mother needs to get to a research hospital because she's dying of pancreatic cancer. I wake up. I'm still in my hotel room. I turn the TV on to an old movie.
You know, we're going to represent something, Tracy, you and I, in our home. Something straight, sound, and fine. That's the wonderful thing about you, Tracy. You're so cool and so much your own. There's a kind of beautiful purity about you, Tracy, like a statue.
George.
Oh, it's grand, Tracy. It's what everybody feels about you. It's what I first worshipped you for from afar.
George, listen.
First, now, and always. Only from a little nearer now, eh, darling?
I don't want to be worshipped. I want to be loved.
Well, you're that too, Tracy. Oh, you're that, all right.
I mean, really loved.
But that goes without saying, Tracy.
No. Now it's you who doesn't see what I mean. Never mind. Run along. I'll be dressed when you get back.
Life is going to a crowded restaurant on your first date with a woman you've admired for years, but were never able to summon the courage to ask out for the evening. And being told there's a waiting list, and the names will be called in alphabetical order, and your name is Zarathustra. And finally, an hour later, when you're seated, a waiter comes to your table and announces that although prices have risen and the service is slower, there's no more food available on the menu. And then you're pressed into service in the kitchen, and your date is taken away on a slave ship and held in a brothel. And you remember the smell of your aunt's linen closet when you were very small. Life is strolling along a boardwalk filled with penguins, sitting on benches at outdoor cafes, drinking lattes, and talking and laughing, when killer whales, in a coordinated attack, leap out from the ocean and belly shimmy their way, jaws snapping, into the main body of penguins, who are thrown into a panic and disorder, the waddling, flightless birds frantically looking for their young, while some of the larger males bravely attempt to put up resistance, only to be swallowed whole, squawking and wriggling down the throats of the killer whales, devoured on the spot. The penguins have been caught in a pincer movement, the whales having planned the attack for weeks in a war room with charts and maps. And finally, satisfied and overstuffed, surrounded by the remains of the penguins, bones, teeth, tails, feathers, beaks, the killer whales, in a state of lethargy, fall asleep and fail to see polar bears floating toward the shore on icebergs fitted with large sails and small outboard motors, the bears wearing goggles, spiked collars, and leather helmets, insignias burned into their fur. When the polar bears reach the shore, they swarm over the killer whales, tear at their throats, and open their bellies to reveal the remains of the not-yet-digested penguins. It's a massacre, and that's life. Penguins eaten by killer whales, who are devoured by polar bears. Life gives you a chamber pot and a piece of Kleenex, then leads you up the steps of a scaffold, wraps a blindfold over your eyes, beats the drum slowly, places a last cigarette in your mouth, a Marlboro 100 light, and fastens a noose around your neck before a large, festive crowd gathered to witness the event. There's a tented pavilion and musicians, everyone in good spirits, waiting for your hanging. And the executioner whispers in your ear, "If you'd been serious about us, you'd have had your teeth fixed. And how many times did I tell you the furniture in your house is too small? That I always feel as though I'm going to break something. Anyway, it's too late now. You deserve more." Life is entering a hotel suite with a beautiful woman you met in the bar downstairs. And as she undresses, she tells you her husband is a verbally abusive drinker, a gun enthusiast and hunter who brings home his trophies, butchering deer and elk in the garage and placing their heads on the walls of their home. But unlike the taxidermied heads of animals you see mounted in ski lodges, he mounts them with a bullet entry hole still visible. The heads of the animals hideously disfigured, ribbons of flesh dangling down from plaques stained with blood spatter. Then she tells you her husband is very jealous, and she's afraid he's been following her. Life is a woman opening a cabinet in a kitchenette, to look for non-dairy creamer. When her boss taps her on the shoulder, perhaps this is inappropriate, he says. I have no business touching you. Perhaps I'm taking advantage of the fact that I'm your superior in the office, with the power to promote or fire you. Perhaps this could be called sexual harassment. But I can't accept that characterization because of the way I feel about you. Look, here's a small velvet box. It's for you. Can you guess what's in it? It's rare, precious, one of only two in the entire world. A contact lens from Edward Teller, the inventor of the atomic bomb. It was found on the street in Berlin, where he was hit by a streetcar and lost his leg. Two burglars breaking into your house, and terrified, you try to act nonchalant. The suave old man. Ah, gentlemen, this is the first time I've ever been robbed, and I find it rather refreshing. You look like you could both use a drink, and you pour three brandy snifters of Napoleon Vial Reserve. Then, cupping the bottoms of your glasses, you all swirl your snifters, inhale deeply the intoxicating fumes, clink glasses, take a sip, and feel the warmth of the liquor spreading within you. Then they throw you to the floor and beat you mercilessly. Life is being a professor of Asian studies, carrying on an affair with the wife of the dean of students, a man who is tragically paralyzed in an automobile accident at an intersection where a teenager, as a practical joke, removed a stop sign, causing the dean to be broadsided by a 16-wheeler going 80 miles an hour. The dean's small, white 1975 Alfa Romeo sports car collapsed and embedded in the grill of the truck, while the dean, held inside by his seatbelt, sustained the injury that left him paralyzed from the neck down. And now, in exchange for his wife's promise never to leave him, in order that their relationship not be tainted by secrets, lies, deceit, or deception, the dean has given her permission to engage in an affair with you, insisting that your lovemaking take place in front of him, in his wheelchair, with oxygen tank and IV drip, so that he might observe and participate to the degree he is capable of, as you serve as a surrogate required for the consummation of the act. Life grabs you by the throat, its thumbs pressed against your Adam's apple. It puts both its fingers in your ears and attempts to inflate you through your nose. It gets you in a half Nelson and bends you forward, pulls down your pants, and asks you for the name of an inexpensive tailor. Life is standing by the bed of your 90-year-old mother as she puts her finger in her mouth, digs into a crevice between her teeth, pulls out a fragment of food, looks at it dangling at the end of her finger, flicks it on the floor, and reaches out to hold your hand while watching the Turner Classics movie channel.
Are you pleased with the gown?
Yes, it's beautiful.
What's the matter, child? What's wrong?
Nothing.
You haven't changed your mind about the wedding, have you?
Oh, no.
If you have, it isn't too late. You know how I feel about him. But I want to make you happy. What is it, child? Aren't you happy? I thought so. I knew there was something on your mind. There, there. What is it, darling? You haven't fallen in love with somebody else, have you? Have you? I haven't seen you cry since you were a baby. This must be serious. Where'd you meet him?
On the road.
Now don't tell me you fell in love with a bus driver.
No. I don't know very much about him, except that I love him.
Well, if it's as serious as all that, we'll move heaven and earth to...
It'll do no good. He despises me.
Oh, come now.
He despises everything about me. He thinks I'm spoiled and pampered and selfish and thoroughly insincere.
Ridiculous.
He doesn't think so much of you, either. He blames you for everything that's wrong about me. Thinks you raised me, stupidly.
Lost a page here. Oh, here we go.
Pick it up a few lines back.
Yep.
He blames you for everything that's wrong about me. Thinks you raised me, stupidly.
Well, what are we going to do about it? Seeing as how you... that's how you feel, why...
It doesn't matter. I've made your life so miserable, and mine too. I'm tired, Father. Tired of running around in circles. He's right. That's what I've been doing ever since I can remember. I've got to settle down. It really doesn't matter how or where or with whom.
You're sitting in the midst of a traffic jam at a red light. You're miserable, thinking, oh God, I hate my life. And you imagine going to a firing range, renting a handgun, and shooting yourself in the head. When you see a young quadriplegic pass in front of you, controlling the motion of his wheelchair by blowing into a pipe. And you think, what kind of life does this man have? Here I am, sitting in my sports car, bemoaning my fate, wondering how I can withstand another day of this agony, while I should be counting my blessings instead of wallowing in self-pity. You see a small group of homeless people standing on the corner, and you know they're not thinking about killing themselves. They're thinking about doing everything they possibly can to survive. And here you are, compared to them, privileged, wealthy, full-bellied, and for a moment you feel shamed out of your state of self-pity. But it doesn't last. It doesn't stay with you for long. Soon, your mind returns to your own misfortunes, and you re-experience that sense of misery and injustice and the desire to make the scales more even. You've been dealt an unfair hand, and a house of cards is stacked against you. A new shopping mall has been built. A huge two-story, atrium-centered, marble and stainless steel structure with waterfalls and interior gardens. A giant clear glass dome over the top. You're browsing in Brookstone's. You inspect a small battery-powered suppository heater, a Japanese shiatsu chair where unseen fists emerge to knead the acupressure points of your back. A device that looks like a slipper into which you slide your foot, and five small guillotines with sensors come down and cut your toenails, which are carried away on a moving conveyor belt and deposited in a hazard waste container. Your favorite is a treadmill with different speeds and angles of ascent, with a video monitor that shows paths through parklands and alpine mountains and tropical rainforests with magnificent birds and howler monkeys. Or, if you prefer, an urban landscape in which you're being pursued by teenage gang members in hooded sweatshirts, holding steel pipes and golf clubs, causing you to run more quickly and increase your heart rate. At a higher setting, you put on a beard, a pair of wire-rimmed glasses, a skull cap, and a fringed prayer shawl. And as you run, you can see on the monitor that you're in Warsaw, Poland, and you're being chased by a group of neo-Nazi thugs wearing death head sweatshirts and swastika armbands. And you can hear them shouting at you, "Hey, Kike, Yid, Jew boy," in the original Polish. And because you're an intellectual, you wonder if Jew boy is hyphenated, while you run even faster. The Aztecs would drug their victims and take them one by one up the terraced steps to the top of their great stone pyramids, where priests would cut out their still beating hearts and offer them up to their gods. They did this to cause the rain to fall on their crops, to prevent pestilence and disease, to ensure that the nearby volcano would not bury them in ash, that the ocean would not encroach upon the land, that their women would be faithful, their children obedient, their parents magnanimous, and their benefactors dead. Prayers that could only be answered by sacrificing citizens on the top of a terraced pyramid deep in the Mesoamerican jungle on a lazy Saturday afternoon. Last night, I dreamt of roller skates and toilet bowls and porcine snouts in which I swam, my body dissolving into bacteria that exploded into a fireworks display that danced across the sky like an ensemble of aquatic celestial colored bubbles. You're driving on a freeway, going about 70, when a huge SUV passes you on the right. The driver is a very pretty young woman, wearing a pair of sunglasses and a baseball cap. She's talking on a cell phone, and it outrages you because you despise people who talk on the phone while driving. And you sit there, fuming, with your half-eaten Subway sandwich in an open wrapper on your lap, your fingers greasy with mayonnaise. When, suddenly, without signaling, the SUV swerves in front of you and clips your fender, and your car veers off and enters a spin in which you see the traffic behind you, and then in front of you, and then behind you, and then in front of you, and your car flips over the median, sending it into rollover, and now you see the sky, and then the pavement, and then the sky, and then the pavement, until finally, you crash through the front of an electronics store and come to a shattering halt in front of a row of television sets.
Thanks, Mary. That's just what I need, a cocktail. Mr. King Wesley is on his way up. That's Mary, the maid.
Oh, okay.
Fine. Have him come in. Well, if it isn't the groom himself... You're just in time, King.
How are you, Ellie? Are you happy?
Happy? Why shouldn't I be happy? I'm getting the handsomest man in captivity. Here you are, King. Let's drink. Let's drink to us. We finally made it, didn't we?
You bet we did.
I want our life to be full of excitement, King. We'll never let up, will we? Never a dull moment. We'll get on a merry-go-round and never get off. Promise. You'll never let me get off.
Whatever you say, darling.
It's the only way to live, isn't it? No time to think. We don't want to think, do we? We just want to keep going. Come on, King. Drink. You're lagging.
I'm at a hotel. Because my apartment building is being fumigated. I'm on Percocet because I don't know what else to be on. I go down to the pool and relax in the sauna. Then, wearing my bathrobe, I walk into the formal dining room, sit down at a table, and place a cell phone call to a radio station. I tell the operator that I'm on the roof of a skyscraper about to jump. She tries to talk me out of it. I ask for the sports department. Now I'm on the phone with a sportscaster. I ask him for the latest scores. As the dining room manager approaches to kick me out of the restaurant, I hang up and walk out to a nearby mall. I buy a ticket for a high-octane action movie. After sitting in the theater for 15 minutes, I returned to the box office and complained that I was misled by the title. I expected to see a nature documentary featuring Australian marsupials. My money is refunded. Still wearing my bathrobe, I enter a department store. I wander down an aisle when a sales clerk comes up to me and asks, "May I help you?" "Yes," I say. "Thank you. I do need help. Life seems meaningless to me. I'm making less and less sense to myself." I don't want to be found dead in my bedroom, wearing only one sock. I don't want to be found dead, holding a book with the word "dead" on its cover. I don't want to be found dead, slumped over in front of a vanity mirror, with mousse on my hair and Bare Minerals SPF 15 medium beige foundation on my face, a pair of nose clippers in my hand. I don't want to be found dead, sprawled on the tile floor of my bathroom, having failed to flush the toilet, my pants and underpants bunched at my ankles, a newspaper and my glasses scattered nearby. I need a woman of compassion, intelligence, humor, and grace, who would not be averse to sitting by my bedside and holding my hand, mopping my brow, combing my hair, giving me a sponge bath, powdering me, sleeping on a wooden chair by my bed throughout the night, and arranging for my cremation and the scattering of my ashes in Morro Bay. San Diego Freeway, 4 in the morning, 80 miles an hour. Pulled over by Jesus dressed as a highway patrolman. He wipes his palm across his forehead, leaving a trail of blood. I fall on my knees begging forgiveness. I'm baptized and sent on a heavenly trajectory toward eternity, dead on arrival.
Reality Check was written, narrated, and produced by Joe Frank, featuring Gideon Brower as the script reader, mixed by Ray Guarna, edited in collaboration with Michael Story. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. I had help this week from newly minted associate producer Nick White. Thanks as always to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support. You can find past episodes of this program at kcrw.com/unfictional. Look for us on Facebook and Twitter, podcast the show on iTunes. I'm Bob Carlson. Please join me next week for Unfictional from kcrw.com.